talking with my guest, Dr. Robert Schock. Doctor, you mentioned earlier that the only place in the world, or two places in the world, that pyramids are not found are Antarctica and Australia. Why do you think that's the case? I mean, how did they miss Australia? Antarctica, I could see, because it's, you know, if it's cold down there, you can see why they didn't go there.
Exactly, yeah. How did they miss Australia? Especially since it's so close to Sunderland. And I don't have any real good explanation for that at this point. What seems to be the case, I mean, this is what I would suggest, is that they seem to have migrated out both toward the east, northeast, toward the west, northwest. They seem to have been going north and easterly and westerly. For whatever reason, they seem not to have headed due south, which is, you know, the way they'd have to go to hit Australia. May have had, I'm only speculating here, but may have had to do with weather patterns, currents, that type of thing at the time. You know,
is there anything in the culture of the Aborigines in Australia, or perhaps even the Maoris in New Zealand, which would tie in with any of the things you're talking about historically? I know that the Aborigines have a great tradition of what they call dreamland, of what was before, and it's very extensive, and there are a lot of characters in there, I mean, figures, birds, and animals and things, and I just wonder, is there any tie-in that you know?
I think there are some tie-ins, and actually this may be the second part of the answer to your question, or a suggestion to the answer. They do seem to have some culture and, I should say, mythology in common, especially stellar mythology as far as things like the Pleiades, the Seven Sisters, as they're often referred to, that the Australians recognize, just like many other cultures in the world, mm-hmm. which I think goes back to Sunderland. As far as actual pyramids, one reason we may, and I'm only speculating here, we may not have pyramids in Australia. First, I think there was not as strong a Sunderland influence, at least the evidence right now, that I have in Australia's other regions. And secondly, you do have in Australia some stone outliers, I would call them, geologically, that essentially are natural pyramids.
You're talking about Ayers Rock?
Yeah, things like Ayers Rock. And, you know, so maybe that substitute, if you would, for artificial pyramids. I mean, you certainly have mountains and whatnot in other parts of the world, but in Australia, for whatever reason, it may be that, especially, you know, they're so magnificent and so isolated, should we say, like classic artificially built pyramids. Again, I'm only speculating.
Sure.
It may also be I honestly don't hold a lot of hope out that we're going to discover pyramids in Australia at this point. I think it's been fairly well covered. But you never know what might
Maybe it's one of those things like you found that would be buried, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You never know. Now, one thing that's very, and I mentioned in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders, is, and I don't want to make a big deal out of it because I don't know, I have my questions about the authenticity, but there are were reported to be Egyptian hieroglyphic inscriptions in Australia. I mean, we're talking now a later period.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, if they're authentic, it means the Egyptians got to Australia.
Well, they have a lot of the paintings, the cave paintings and wall paintings that the Aborigines did. Now, you're saying that possibly there's some of the hieroglyphics
there's a region, I think it's called Gosford, in Australia, where there are clear Egyptian hieroglyphic inscriptions.
Mm-hmm.
The question is whether they're authentic ancient inscriptions or whether it's essentially a 100-year-old hoax.
I see what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, so that's what I'm referring to there very specifically. But my point is right now that classically, many traditional scholars would simply say it has to be a hoax, not on the basis of examining the evidence firsthand, but because, you know, the classic dogma is before the time of Columbus, people could not travel across oceans.
So therefore, it couldn't happen.
It can't happen.
Yeah.
Tying in with that, and I don't exaggerate here, I remember decades ago now, a freshman student in an anthropology course. I was in an anthropology course, and we were told very, very bluntly that a wonderful laboratory to understand and explore civilization was comparing the civilizations of the quote New World, North and South America, to those of the Old World, because obviously they rose absolutely independently of each other and there was never any contact between the two. Why? It's obvious, because oceans separate them and no one could cross oceans before Columbus. I mean, that was my point is that was simply the accepted dogma.
Well, I was taught that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so,
and,
I mean,
it's... For many people, it still is a dogma.
Yeah,
As I try to outline in my book, there's, I believe, just plenty of evidence to indicate otherwise.
Well, you have the terrible situation of the discovery of the Kennewick Man up
right.
in Washington, where, I mean, if in fact he was what they thought he was, it would change the whole concept of migration of peoples in North
right.
America. And so to handle it, they simply tried to destroy it.
Right, exactly.
You know, which I think is tragic.
Oh, it's very tragic. But, you know, even if we don't have, I mean, even if they, which they hadn't, have not been able to do. I mean, even if it had been destroyed, in fact, Kennewick Man is not the only evidence for things happening other than what dogma has said.
Yeah.
For instance, it's a side issue, and now we're going back 13, 14, 15,000 years. The original peopling of North America, the traditional dogma, if you would, which I certainly learned as an undergraduate many years ago, was that they came over Beringia, the Bering Land Bridge.
Right.
At the end of the Ice Age, they came from Mongolia and Siberia, and that was that. They came down and they became the Paleo-Indians, which became the indigenous American population, and there was no influence from anywhere else at any other time, and that's simply not the case. First off, just very quickly, all the evidence is they came much earlier, like, you know, tens of thousands of years earlier, and secondly, there is now clear evidence that some of them were not just coming from Asia, Mongolia, and Siberia, but some were coming from Europe, even as early as, say, 13,000 years ago.
Hmm. Wasn't there also, I just remembered, that I read about a mummy that was found in China, or
mm-hmm.
one of several, that yeah. had white skin and red hair.
Absolutely, absolutely. These have now been found in China and Mongolian region of China, mm-hmm. northern China. And they're basically a common term for them, or, you know, we might call them colloquial Celts or Celts, Celtic.
Mm-hmm.
They're Europeans, and they've got not just fair skin and red hair, some of them, but they've got typical European fabrics and clothing, and yet they go back to 1000 BC or earlier. So, I mean, there was incredible intermixing and interchange in ancient times that we're only beginning to become aware of, and is absolutely against, you know, standard traditional dogmatic.
What's the significance of all this?
There's a common unity to humankind, to mankind, that I think we're some of us are aware of, or maybe perhaps always have been aware of, but other people want to stress the differences and the distinctions between different countries and different groups of people. You know, maybe mm-hmm. for their own political purposes or whatever. I don't want to speculate on that now. But I think there really is a common unity and unity of civilization. And my reconstruction, all civilization actually has its origins in a single spot, in a single source, and we're all sort of branches of that. So that's one thing. Another is something we've talked about, which is... we go back a lot further and a lot you know, civilization goes back a lot further than has generally been estimated. It was a lot more sophisticated. Even if you're using reed boats or rafts, to navigate across oceans is, you know, that takes an incredible amount of sophistication.
Also, foresight.
And foresight, yeah. I mean, I think a lot of sophistication in ancient times was a different, if I could, a different type of sophistication than we're used to in modern times. People now think sophistication is having, you know, Windows XP on their computer. You know, it's a technological type of sophistication versus understanding, for instance, an understanding of astronomy and having a foresight. So the people that, you know, are, and again, I have XP on a computer, but the people that think of that is, computers as sophistication, that's very different than someone who can go out and be on the open ocean and figure out exactly where they are and where they're going and have the foresight to figure out, you know, how to make it to, you know, a very small island or a certain region on a continent thousands of miles away. So there's sort of different levels, that's what I'm trying to say, or different types of sophistication.
Or to even want to do it
and
to anticipate the fact that there'll be something there when you get there, wherever there is.
Exactly.
Very brave on top of it. How does religion fit into all of this? Because I was quite taken with your one description you had there. You were talking about the Aztecs and their bloody sacrificial rites, which were really quite horrendous when you find out what they did. And it suddenly brought to mind that my uncle was head of the Spanish department at Cal Berkeley, and did a lot of translation, and he translated a book called Cortez, The Life of the Conqueror by his secretary. And the whole book was this diary kept by Cortez's secretary, and my uncle translated it, and the book is still in print. But I was reading that one a while ago, and his descriptions of the Spanish reaction to the violence of the Aztec civilization was really quite amazing, and it tied in perfectly with your description as well. It was pretty bloody. Not all religions were bloody.
No, not all religions were bloody, and not all religions were bloody in a literal sense. Although I've got to say, based on my research, and you know, I don't want to overstress this, but I think part of the message too is that I think that, you know, all the dominant religions, certainly Judaism, Christianity, Islam, etc., they really are rooted in what I would call sky religion, you know, reaching up to the skies. As we talked about natural catastrophes, the pyramids play a role in that, in trying to reach up to the skies and sort of reunite stability and order mythologically or ritualistically. And all of them, frankly, were fairly bloody. Some were more literally bloody, in my estimation, than others were. The Aztecs are maybe one extreme of literal blood.
Really?
But you know, even when you look at classical Judaism or classical Christianity, I mean, they are bloody religions in the sense of involving sacrifices, not always sacrifices of humans, but in some cases sacrifices of humans, whether it's literally or ritualistically, for instance, in the communion. And the communion, you know, the Catholic or the Christian communion is something that, interestingly, you find in indigenous cultures in many other parts of the world, including the Americas. And I think that goes back to, again, a common origin, and a common origin that may ultimately have been, as Aztecs continued to express it until the 15th and 16th century, you know, a common origin of actual human sacrifice.
Which they did, in fact, at least from your description, practiced cannibalism as well.
Oh, yeah, and that actually was that cannibalism in the later period, in later Aztec period, is interesting because it was probably both had sort of its ties, in my opinion, in ritualism and the general religion, if we could call it the pyramid religion, for lack of a better term right now, but also probably, you know, ecological reasons.
I mean, what do you mean?
Get more meat into the diet.
Well, that is a source of meat. No, but it is a source of meat.
Yeah, exactly. And this has been seriously proposed by various anthropologists, nutritionists, that it was a time of stress. And it actually was a way to get more meat into the diet, at least for those that were the dominants, you know, those that won the war.
So of course, that would explain why they died out, because if you wind up killing and eating everybody, you're going to wind up with only two people left.
Right, exactly. And, of course, the Spanish helped.
Well, that's true.
I was going to say, it's also a little bit ironic, I think, sometimes when you look at how bloody the Aztecs and some of the American indigenous cultures were. Now I'm talking 16th century.
Yes.
And so then the Spanish, et cetera, the conquistadors come over, and they're horrified by this. So what do? They massacre them all. You know, they're just as bloody in some cases. But they're doing it for the, quote, right reasons.
Of course, of course. What about the belief, particularly among those groups down there, that they were waiting for the white god to come back from across the sea? And, and I've heard all kinds of theories of, you know, that represents Jesus, that represents, you know, the second coming. And what's the origin of that, and how does that fit into any of this?
Well, actually, I think that ties in with ultimately going back to what I was talking about, the migrations or the movements across across oceans. And in fact, so that, if we could use the term myth, some of those myths and traditions were in fact recording real events of people moving across the oceans. I mean, I don't want to play up too much the concept of race, and that had to be a white god, or although that certainly was part of it.
Well, that, at least that's what they believed at that time. I mean, I'm talking about everybody, but
that's
theirs.
That's absolutely what they believed, and that in this case would indicate, you know, and you're talking across the Atlantic, essentially Europeans, and that there was a European influence. And that's following up on what we were talking about before, going, you know, there was various periods of migration. So there was the initial, as I see it, migration out of Sundaland, and you're talking, you know, about 4,000 BC and earlier. There were other periods of major migration later than that. And again, I correlate that in Voyages of the Pyramid Builders with periods of increased stress, increased catastrophe, increased cometary activity, increased climate changes. So some of these traditions that we're talking about that were recorded in the 16th century, I think, go back to those later periods of migration.
You're a geologist.
Yeah.
Do you see that today we are undergoing more Earth movement activity?
That's a really good question, because a lot of people contend that to be the case.
Seems that way to me.
And it does seem like that way. I don't dismiss that as a distinct possibility.
Uh-oh. We'll pursue that. We're at the top of the hour. I'll give us all a couple of minutes to sort of take a deep breath and try to find out what's next as we continue with our guest, Dr. Robert Schoch, S-C-H-O-C-H. The book is Voyages of the Pyramid Builders. He also wrote Voices of the Rocks. You can get information, of course, from www.robertschoch.homestead.com or check with your bookstore or Amazon. They'll be there. I'm Barbara Simpson. Stay right where you are. We'll be back.